until Mitch comes back.
I'm back.
And if it starts getting noisy, I'll put it in lecture mode again, and you guys can hear us, but we can't hear you. And then we'll try to take some time a little bit later in the call and answer some of your questions, things like that.
I'm with you, Mike.
Okay, good. I just want to get a quick sound check with you, Mitch, and you sound okay. All right, I'm going to go ahead and introduce, and then we'll get going.
Sounds good.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike Jay, and welcome to our call today in the hot summer of July 2006. I have a guest, Mitch Axelrod. Mitch, how are you?
I'm great, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I appreciate your notes from time to time and want to support you and your work, and as I know that you are supporting mine. What started off this conversation, folks, was our Interdependence Day that we celebrated on July the 5th with Dr. Don Beck. And Mitch dropped me a note and said that he was doing similar things and wanted to know if we could talk. And I thought, well, you know, we can talk, and I think the best way to do that is to share that conversation with other people. So that's the backdrop for this Executive Coaching Club call. Mitch, tell people a little bit, and just do this right quick. Mitch, tell people a little bit about yourself, about how you have arrived and about where you are right now.
I've been self-employed for 27 years. I coined the term about 20 years ago, psychologically unemployable. And that's because I tried to work inside of a company when I first got out of college, found it didn't work for me. And so I went out on my own in 1978 and essentially have been self-employed ever since. I have had businesses over the years. I've made a lot of money. I was a millionaire at 32 and dead broke at 34. So I've gone through a lot of changes over the past 27 years. And about 1988, I started working with a fellow named Brian Tracy because I realized that what I loved to do more than anything was to teach. And I really didn't want to be a teacher, primarily because of the system and the pay scale. So when I saw what Brian was doing, I said, I can do that. And so I plunked down $13,000 in 1988, right after literally losing $500,000 in a bad business venture, and embarked on what was then a second career. And it's taken me now 18 years, I guess, of full-time work to be totally committed to my speaking and consulting. And the past 10 years, I have been essentially a full-time stay-at-home dad. So the reason I share that with you is because over the years I've recognized that probably the single most important skill of all is adaptability, the willingness to consciously change. And because I've had to change, I've had to adapt. I coined a phrase about 15 years ago called the new game. And in 2000, I guess, I came back out with the new game as a formal brand. And that's what intrigued me about your interdependence was because the real seismic shift in the new game is interdependence, that we've come through a dependent age, then to an independent age, and now, as you so eloquently said and hit the nail right on the head, we're now in an interdependent age. And over, I guess, about 15 years ago, in 1991, I was going through one of those major life changes, a separation from my wife at the time, and a friend of mine introduced me to a tool, and he said, here, do this thing, takes you 15 minutes, and then send it back to me, and I'll return a report to you. And I did it and sent it off, and 2 weeks later I get in the mail like this 30-page report, and I'm reading through it, and I could not believe what this thing was telling me. So I got on the phone, I said, hey, what's going on here? You know more about me than most of the people I've been with in all my life. What's the trick? He said, welcome to the world of axiology. And I said, you got to be kidding me. Axelrod, axiology, you know, is this my science? He says, no, this is the science of human values. And it's been around forever. And the guy who was the pioneer, Dr. Robert Hartman, was nominated for a Nobel Prize in 1973 because for the first time in history, he actually cracked the code on how you can take what was previously an immeasurable thing, values, and turned it into a measurable mathematical model. And for his work, he was nominated for a Nobel Prize, and unfortunately, in 1973, the same year, he died. And his work kind of went underground for 15 years or so until a doctoral student of his, Wayne Carpenter, was able to take his work, computerize it, and now in literally seconds, we can develop and give you a profile of how you actually think and value, and then translate that into more than 200 different capacities that enable you to see what do you bring to the game. And so I started to use it in my my personal work. I started to use it with my clients, with my employees. Little by little, it grew. And about 4 years ago, we struck a deal with Axiometrics, which is the copyright holder to the profile software. And now we are one of four worldwide marketing resellers, essentially license holders of this phenomenal tool. And that's kind of what brings us to today.
So tell me a little bit about Hartman. I have studied and read one of his books. Tell me a little bit about him, his background, and because I think people would find that very interesting.
Well, all of this came out of Germany pre-World War II. Dr. Hartman was a lawyer. He was a magistrate. And he was watching, as Hitler was coming to power, he was watching his entire country, his homeland that he loved so much, literally begin to transform right before his very eyes. And he started to actually put some of Hitler's henchmen in jail until they put a bounty on his head and essentially forced them out of Germany. He left Germany in the late 30s, and he spent the rest of his life trying to answer a profound question. And the question was, why does a killer in war get a medal when a killer in peace gets the electric chair? What is it that could happen in the thinking of an entire nation that would permit the state to take over and literally exterminate people, intrinsically valuable people, based on an ideology? And he studied axiology for the rest of his life until he died. And in the early 1960s, he was teaching a class for Eric Fromm. And Eric Fromm said to him, listen, this is all great in theory, but if you had a tool, something that we could use that actually could measure this, then this would be really practical and really useful, and it would take it from the realm of philosophy and theory into the realm of practical application. And so Dr. Hartman spent years, came up with what is now called the Hartman Value Profile. It is owned by the Hartman Institute. It's a two-page survey form in which you rank order 18 items from best to worst. And that's it. It takes about 15 minutes to do the entire thing. And then Hartman went about proving mathematically using calculus and scientific models that each of these items had a different value. And based upon the way you rank order things, which is essentially based upon the way you value things, which is essentially based on the idea of what you give meaning to, we could actually determine what your value system is or your value structure. And he was the first one to go from what was before then intangible and very hard to measure to a mathematical model, a three-dimensional model. And so he turned what was a moral philosophy into a mathematical system. And it's actually called the calculus of values. And what he came up with was astounding. He said that there's three dimensions of value in the world. And there's same three dimensions of value exist within ourselves. So essentially you've got a three-dimensional model of value, and we apply that either by how we operate outside of ourselves, what I would call the outer game, and then how do we operate inside ourselves. And that three-dimensional model was considered so groundbreaking that Viktor Frankl, who most of us know, approached Dr. Hartman in the late 60s, early 70s to create an institute to study values in the United States. And originally it was going to be values and logotherapy, which is Viktor Frankl's work. And unfortunately, Hartman died. But most of the people like Albert Ellis, Viktor Frankl, Eric Fromm, even Abraham Maslow were colleagues of Hartman. And what they said was that what he discovered was literally as groundbreaking as what Galileo had discovered, because it was the first time we could actually make meaning out of and measure how we value and make meaning out of the world. And so now, because of computers and because of the speed and access that we have, we can take this idea and now give people back reports. from different angles of how their value system or value structure either gives them clarity or blind spots, what you pay attention to, what you don't pay attention to, and then we can project that out into all kinds of different things like stress. We can measure seven different levels of mental stress. Fear, we can actually measure five different kinds of fear that cause people to hesitate or to become debilitated. So there's these various categories of things that we can measure, and then within each category we can measure various capacities.
And so can you elaborate on the categories a little bit for those of us that study other models to see what kind of overlap there is?
Well, the categories, the interesting thing about this two-page profile, which, by the way, the two-page profile, many companies have access to. All you have to do is be a consultant in good standing with the Hartman Institute. It's the reports that come out of it, and because the partner in our world who's working with us was the only link back to Dr. Hartman, he's created like 50 different looks or angles in which we can measure. So categorically, you've got all kinds of things like empathy. We can measure your empathy. We can measure your practical thinking. We can measure things like initiative and self-determination. We can measure drive, for example. There's another profile that we have that actually measures your focus, your fire, your faith, and your fear. And faith, we don't mean religious faith. We mean faith in the present, faith in the future, things like that. So there's all kinds of different categories of things. For example, project management. If you have a person who you're putting in charge of a project and you want to know if that person can manage the different aspects of the project, we have a project management report that will measure 11 different categories vital to getting any project done. So with one set of data, which is the most amazing thing to me, one set of data, we can identify all these different categories, all these different activities, and then run simple reports that will give you measures as to how strong or how developed that particular capacity is. And it all comes from this simple three-dimensional model. You know, if you think about, you can find anybody on the planet if you have latitude, longitude, and altitude, and that's because of the triangulation. And it's a similar modality here. We have intrinsic values, extrinsic values, and systemic values, which are the three dimensions. Then we can identify and triangulate exactly where a person's thinking is at and how they make meaning out of the world and give them an amazingly accurate picture of exactly where they are in the universe.
That's pretty amazing. How do you deal with the people who say to all of us who use assessments that this doesn't recognize the differences in people and it doesn't value people for who they are in the moment, things like that? What kinds of objections can you talk about there?
Well, you know, I think it would be really good. The objections that we get, once people understand what we're actually measuring, we really don't get objections, because once people see what those three dimensions are, then they understand that this is unlike any other, quote, assessment. We don't even call it an assessment because it's scientifically based, first off. Second off, assessments are only one aspect of what we can measure. So most of the time, we don't get objections from people in terms of the value or the accuracy. We just get some people who say, well, this, I may not agree with this or may disagree with something else. But most of the time, and I've run literally thousands and thousands of profiles over the past 15 years on people from best-selling authors and entertainers and celebrities and athletes to, you know, everybody throughout the spectrum, business people, stay-at-home moms, everybody, and 99.9% of the time people are just blown away. We do have occasion where people say, you know, this is not me, I don't believe it, and we just say, fine, that's okay. Give your money back, and we're happy to do that. But that happens so infrequently, and here's why. what Hartman came up with was that there's a hierarchy of value in the universe. And he called these three dimensions of value intrinsic, extrinsic, and systemic. Those are the official terms. And what they essentially mean is that values are actually only one dimension of value, which is a huge breakthrough in terms of how people see things and how people value things. At that systemic level, a systemic value is something that's conceptual and it's absolute. So anything conceptual is systemic in value. That would mean things like mission, purpose, vision, goals, achievement drive, direction that you might be headed. Okay, all of those things are conceptual. And everything that exists in concept is two-dimensional. And the reason is because it either exists or it doesn't. It's an absolute measurement of value. So when you look at, for example, business plans, or you look at systems like the law, everything is two-dimensional. It's either legal or it's illegal. It's either good or it's bad. It's either right or it's wrong. So when we value something systemically, we essentially value it based on its concept and its absolute value. It either is or it isn't. This is the dimension that's commonly known as values. Things like beliefs, expectations, principles, everything that is on that list exists in concept. It's not real. Now, that's not to say you can't convert a principle into an action, but if you look at a principle or a value system or a belief or a concept like that, honor, duty, all right, those things are conceptual, and everybody's idea of those things is different. And so when you ask somebody about their value system, if you ask 6 billion people on the planet, you would actually get 6 billion different value systems because no two people have the exact same idea of things. That's the systemic level. Hartman said, and proved, by the way, that level of value is the lowest level of value, because it's only two-dimensional. And he said that when something goes from the concept level to the real tangible level, you move up to the higher level of extrinsic value. And extrinsic value is simply defined as anything that's concrete and tangible. So you have things like, for example, anything you can taste, touch, smell, you know, five senses. You have concrete things. So you have getting results, the roles that we play, anything that we do. Another way to frame the extrinsic dimension is the doing dimension, as opposed to the systemic dimension, which is the thinking dimension. So the example I often use is the difference of a concept of a car or the architectural blueprints of a house and the actual car itself or the house itself. You can't build a house without the blueprints. So the blueprints are very, very valuable, the concept of the house. But you can't live in the concept of a house. So until that house goes from concept, blueprint, to real structure, it stays in the systemic realm. Once it becomes a structure, real, tangible, concrete, that you can live in, taste it, touch it, feel it, it's now extrinsic in value. Now, why the extrinsic dimension is more valuable than the systemic dimension, why doing is more valuable than thinking, is because it is multidimensional, meaning there's all kinds of different sizes of houses. There's all kinds of different shapes of houses, cars, things like that. Everything that exists in the real world has multiple dimensions to it, whereas everything that exists in the ideal world, the concept world, has only two dimensions. It either is or it isn't. And so the extrinsic world, you have things like getting results, a bias for action, practical thinking falls into the extrinsic dimension of value. You have concrete thinking, all right, and getting things done now. A tendency to see other people maybe in functional ways as opposed to other ways. So whenever you move into that higher dimension of extrinsic value, you know it because it's real, tangible, and concrete. Now, when you look at the highest dimension of value, Hartman said, is there something that's more valuable than the extrinsic world? And he termed it the intrinsic world. And what made the intrinsic world the highest value is because it's unique and singular. So that anything that is unique and singular has more value than anything that's real, concrete, and abundant. And so I use the example of John Lennon's piano. You can't play the concept of a piano, but you could buy the kind of piano that John Lennon owned for maybe $30,000. John Lennon's piano sold, I understand, for close to $2 million. Why? Simple. There's only one of them. So anything that we value intrinsically, we value for its uniqueness, for its one-of-a-kindness. So, for example, if you think back to the table that you may have shared with your family around dinner when you grew up, all right, conceptually, systemically, that table was just a table. Extrinsically, who knows? It could have been an expensive table or it could have been an inexpensive table. But intrinsically, that table was a special table, especially if you have fond memories, if it had meaning for you. Why? Because it was a one of a kind. It created an experience. So intrinsic value has to do with empathy, self-esteem, how we feel about ourselves for who we are, not for what we do or where we're going. It has to do with how we value other people. So do we value people for who they are without expectation? Do we value people for who they are without feeling like they ought to be different or should be different? Do we value people for who they are, or do we value them only for what they get done? All right. That's the intrinsic dimension of value. And when Hartman finished his mathematics, what came out of this was a provable model that intrinsic value was more valuable than extrinsic value, and both of those were more valuable than systemic value. And so what's happened now is we've got a model for literally every decision and choice that we make has some systemic consequence or impact, extrinsic and intrinsic. And how we're able to bring clarity of thinking to each choice usually will measure how well we make that choice. And so what the profile actually measures, the only thing on the planet that can do it is clarity of thinking. We can actually tell you with very pinpoint precision how clear is your thinking in these three dimensions of value, how much attention do you put on them, and then where are your blind spots? And when we can help people identify their blind spots, not to mention the untapped strengths that they have that they're not using because maybe they're paying attention to something else, amazing things happen. Literally, it's a game-changing experience.
Amazing. You know, one of the things about intrinsic and extrinsic and systematic is that when I was studying how the brain works, and we're trying to understand how valuing becomes the central process of the neuronal system, it seems to me that that would correlate with the intrinsic nature of things, being that every decision that's made in our cognition or sensation or in our emotion has at the very core of it a valuing function in the center of the neuronal cell that's deciding to fire or not fire. And I think that this is one of the things that many people who are shoving values aside and looking for other leverage are failing to understand, that at the root of all life is a valuing function.
Yeah, I don't know much about that aspect of things. What I do know, though, is that, and having used this and experienced it, is it's a very simple model, which is very appealing to me. I like things that can be simple. It's three-dimensional, so it has kind of perfect synergy. And from a real pragmatic perspective, what it does is it gives people insight to see what they cannot see. It's like being unconsciously incompetent, not knowing what you don't know, not being able to see what you can't see. And most of us, myself included, operate that way. And what we're finding is a frightening, truly a frightening pattern. And it's played out locally, it's played out individually, and now it's being played out globally. I remember your last call where you were talking about interdependence, and the idea of peace came up, you know, world peace, and the importance of the whole planet becoming more interdependent as opposed to competitive to grab their share of the pie at the expense of somebody else's share of the pie. What's interesting about that conversation in axiology is that Dr. Hartman's goal with axiology was actually one of world peace. He said that the only way that people can begin to really respect and appreciate each other for who they were is to revert back to the hierarchy of value order. And when that hierarchy gets thrown out of whack, so in other words, we overvalue the lower dimension of value and undervalue the higher dimensions of value, I call it a values inversion. He called it systemic abuse. The answer to his question, why does a killer in war get a medal when a killer in peace gets the electric chair, came down to something he called systemic abuse. And essentially, it's when we invert our values to the point where we will put an ideology or the state, for example, which is an ideology or a system, ahead of humanity. And there was an amazing scene in the movie Schindler's List where when the Jews were walking up to the table after getting off the trains to be checked into the concentration camp, the officer behind the table asked one question, essential or non-essential? That was the question. And if you were essential, meaning functionally essential, not essential as a human being, but if you were functionally essential, you went off into one line and you made a contribution to the camp and you stayed alive. If you were non-essential, you went into the other line, which walked into the gas chamber. So essentially what they were doing was valuing a human being not based on the value of the being, but only based on the systemic value or the functional value of whether or not they were essential to be able to run the camp, or non-essential, in which case they had zero value. And that is the essence of what Hartman said, is this inversion of values. Now, if you look at this on a daily level, forgetting just, you know, taking it back, dialing it back to not the global level, but to an individual level on a day-by-day basis, if you look at the idea of a goal, we are a goal-obsessed culture. And in my estimation, this is just one man's opinion, a lot of the success movement is fueling this. I think they're doing it with good intentions, but they don't know what they don't know. And here's what they don't know. And Stephen Covey actually pointed this out in his book, The Seven Habits, but it got lost with one of the other seven habits, and that is that your goals are not as valuable as your roles. Let me say it again. Your goals, your vision, your mission, your purpose, all of that's important, but none of it is as valuable as your roles in life. Why? Because a goal, a mission, a purpose is a concept. It's an idea. It's important, but it's just an idea. Your role in life, your roles in life are how you use up the precious seconds, moments, days of your life. And in the hierarchy of value, roles, because it's what you do, are more valuable than goals, which is where you're going. And most of us, myself included, I'm just as, you know, culturally conditioned as the next guy. About 70% of us are like this, where we put such a heavy emphasis on that goal, that direction that we're headed, that in many cases what we do is we alter our roles, we alter our lives and how we do our lives to achieve a goal without ever necessarily stopping and looking and saying, wait a second, is this valuable for me? Is this something that's important for me? And will I enjoy the journey along the way? Is the trade-off of that one moment of goal achievement worth all the sacrifice of time which you can't get back to get there? And for about 70% of us, we say, yes, it's worth it. Everybody has to make their own value choices. However, in order of hierarchy, your role is more valuable. So rather than setting up a goal and then reorganizing your whole life to achieve that goal, and in many cases, for a lot of people, at least 70 to 80% of them who are working at least, who say they would change jobs in a heartbeat if they could, but they can't because they have this goal to live a certain lifestyle, by reordering that, you decide what roles are really important to me, and then set the goals in the context of the role. This way, whether you achieve the goal or not, you know, success versus failure in that absolute world of goal, no goal, you can enjoy the journey because every day you're doing something that brings you joy, satisfaction, fulfillment. It enables you to tap and utilize your God-given talent, your natural talent, as opposed to having to feel like you're using up your time and you've got your music still left in you. And when Dr. Covey talked about this in his book, The Seven Habits, he actually did say explicitly, set your roles first and then set your goals. Unfortunately, few people remember that, but most people remember begin with the end in mind. And begin with the end in mind is a future vision goal-oriented process. It's a system, really. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's good. It's important. Yet it's not as important as your role. So if you begin with the end in mind and you give up your life for that goal and you get there and you realize, wow, that wasn't a really great trade-off, you've essentially just given up something very precious and irreplaceable, which is your time. I'll finish this part by a quote that Dr. Hartman blew me away when I read this. He said, our lore is full of stories of men laying down their lives for the sake of what they think or what they have or what they want. But how many have laid down what they think or have or want for the sake of their lives? And
That's a great piece.
Isn't that powerful? It's like gives me the chills when I read it.
Well, you know, it excites me because this morning I had my final Coach to Yoga class, and in my review, I talked about this very thing, that simplicity on the other side of complexity has to do with our knowing, our self-knowledge, our role-based direction versus the goal-directed activity that comes to us through existential needs. And I think that you know, this is powerful because not only does it validate what we're trying to get people to understand, because you can't keep pace with complexity as it is today. It's growing exponentially, and therefore one goal is quickly outdated and a new one falls in place. So you get into a situation to where you have what's called the Red Queen effect, where the Red Queen is about a story of the foxes who became faster and began to catch more rabbits, and then over time the rabbits that were left became faster and outran the foxes until the foxes could become faster. In other words, no one gets away from it. It's a story of just one-upsmanship. And yep. Once you get on that merry-go-round, it's very difficult to lose sight of who you are, very difficult to lose sight of roles. You know, I started probably like a lot of people our age. I think you and I are probably similar ages and have probably had similar experience, including not being able to work for anybody our whole lives. That's why interdependence means so much to people like you and me, who are very independent because of our value systems. We have to go to the next level and become interdependent in order for us to be able to leverage the work that we're doing independently. And the interesting thing about Covey's work is that I think that Covey is misinterpreted a lot of the times because people don't understand really the range of work that he's done. So when he talks about beginning with the end in mind, it doesn't mean beginning with the end in mind as a goal. It means beginning with the end in mind as a role. And that this is what most people misapply. I was studying with Boyatzis at Case Western a few years ago when we were kind of heavy into emotional intelligence, which we've sort of grown out of to some extent because of the emphasis on self-awareness versus self-knowledge. But he indicated that in their research that only 33% of the people that they studied in organizations, and Haymick Burr was a huge group that studied lots of people in lots of organizations, only a third of those were motivated by goals. So of the 70% who are following goals, even half of those are not really motivated. They're following along like sheep because they believe that what the culture rewards them for is attaining this or that or whatever. And we're constantly being forced in the coaching industry to look at people who are always talking about greatness, about winning, about success, when in fact that's all goal-driven. It's not role-driven at all. And it's not, in most cases, allowing people to focus on their strengths. It's always putting people into gap-based work to where they're constantly working on deficiencies to, quote-unquote, achieve some kind of goal balance rather than looking at what a role is. And if you look at a role is completely out of balance. A role is always based on a particular set of circumstances that are differentiated in a particular way. And this whole focus that we have in modern-day society, at least in the U.S., now one of the things that I'm finding is that the rest of the world, unfortunately, does not have this virus. and we're trying to give it to them like mad. And there are people in these other cultures that are picking it up. And it is really distorting their cultures as I'm seeing it. In fact, that's one of the things that I want to talk to people about the Culture Club, is that when you get to places like Russia and Asia, even places in Europe, there is not a goal focus anymore. There's not a work focus. It's much more about the quality of life. It's much more about how people live together. It's not this tremendous go out and get them, beat them, you know, type of atmosphere that we have developed in the, you know, model that we're using in North America. And I think that this is something that I don't know whether Hartman did cross-cultural work. It seems like he would have. Did he find that there were certain kinds of differences in cultures across the world, or did he find, obviously he found similar values in all cultures, but did he note that there were systematic differences in values between cultures?
That's a great question, and you just said a mouthful, man. Let me tell you, I'm sitting here cheering everything you're saying. And if I forget, I want you to bring me back to motivation and stress, because we can actually measure motivation. I want to comment on two things you said regarding motivation and stress and what the three biggest stress factors that are showing up right now in the world are, and they're showing up in about 80 to 90% of us. But let me step back for a second. Big distinction you just brought up between value and values, and I want to reiterate this and kind of go drill down a little deeper. The three dimensions are value, not plural, value, singular. Values are one dimension of value. Values, which we commonly think of as values, a belief system, an ideology, principles, things like that, all fall into the systemic realm of value. They're all concepts and ideas. So here's the paradox. Obviously, you know that my brand is The New Game. I wrote The New Game of Business, and we kind of frame this as The New Game of Values, even though it's kind of an old game. But a big distinction here is that if you look at paradox, right, and here's a paradox. The paradox, as opposed to paradigm, the paradox is that values literally are different from person to person. That if you could actually sit down with every single person on the planet and have them write out a list of concepts and ideas and ideology and beliefs that they have, and you demanded that they come up with at least, let's say, 18 of them, which is how many items are in the value profile, you would come up with 6.4 quadrillion different combinations of values. All right, that's why we can measure. Using the profile, we can measure so uniquely. We're measuring you. We're not comparing you to the bell-shaped curve or anything else, because there's 6.4 quadrillion different ways you can rank order 18 items from best to worst, and we have two sets of them. So when you look at values as a subset of value, yes, it's absolutely true. Every single person's values are different. Now, do we categorize people in communities or religions or groupings? Sure, because if you adhere to, let's say, the Jewish tradition, you're considered of Jewish values, or Christian or Buddhist or whatever. But in the bigger context of value, it's universal. So whether you are in China, Germany, America, Japan, Russia, the Middle East, it doesn't matter. Systemic value is the lowest level of value, extrinsic value is a higher level of value, and intrinsic value is the highest level of value. This is universal, it is not cultural, and whether you're a child in Beirut now, God love them, or you're a child in South America, or you're a child in America, or you're a child in Africa, every single one of those children is equal in value. There is no distinction intrinsically. Extrinsically, sure, you have some that are rich, some that are poor. You have some that eat until they burst, and then you have others that can't find a grain of food in the course of a week. So extrinsically, yeah, there's all kinds of different comparative value. But when you're dealing with humanity, every single human being is intrinsically valuable, irreplaceable, immeasurable. And yet we don't treat ourselves like that. What I was alluding to earlier about stress, the three biggest stress factors that show up right now, and they show up across the board because we can measure seven different stress factors: role frustration, goal frustration, and self-sufficiency.
Say those again.
Self-sufficiency, which is the intrinsic value. In other words, how much do you value yourself? Role frustration, which is the frustration that we get when we're not doing our lives, using our talents and ability, underutilizing our ability, not playing the roles that we really would love to play. Goal frustration is the distance between where we think we ought to be and where we are today. Okay? So let's take it from the bottom up. Goal frustration, that's a systemic value. If you get pounded on that you've got to set goals, and they got to set the goals to the stars, and if you miss the stars, you'll hit the moon, in that dimension of value, because goals are systemic, it's an either-or game. You either win it or you lose it. You either reach the goal or you don't. That game is a zero-sum game, and so it's a win or lose game. So it's not like, well, I got halfway to my goal, I'm going to celebrate. No, you either make your goal or you don't make your goal. 75% of the people we've profiled in the last 5 years have goal frustration, meaning they think they ought to be somewhere other than where they are, or they've fallen short of their goal, and in the absolute world of all or nothing, win or lose, they've lost. And so they're frustrated because they're where they actually are, what is today, which is all that matters, is not where they think they ought to be, and the distance between those two, the gap, is goal frustration. The larger the gap, the more the frustration in that dimension. Role frustration is a different malady. It's a different stress factor. It's a stress factor that says, I feel like I'm going to die with my music left in me, that I'm not utilizing my talent, that I'm getting up and doing things that I may even not enjoy, that every day the clock is going by, that I'm using my most precious resource, my time, in ways that are not valuable to me, in ways that are not productive for me. Maybe I've got somebody else's idea of what I should be doing, should be, ought to be. Those are all systemic. And I can't get off that treadmill. That's role frustration. That's showing up now in about 70% of the people that we profile. Self-sufficiency is what you would commonly call, and it's actually mislabeled, low self-esteem. I have said for years there is no such thing as low self-esteem. The whole low self-esteem movement has got a faulty premise to it, and the false premise leads to a false prescription. In the world of intrinsic value, who you are We call it self-esteem for a label, but who you are, how you esteem yourself for who you are, is an intrinsic value. Intrinsic value cannot be measured, so there's no high or low intrinsic value. There's no high self-esteem or low self-esteem. There's only attention and clarity. And what we commonly think of as low self-esteem is really an inattention to our intrinsic value, or a lack of clarity that we actually have intrinsic value. And so all the solutions, the prescriptions out there to get rid of, quote, low self-esteem won't work if a person doesn't know their clarity around how they feel about who they are, as distinct from what they do or where they're going. And so one of the ways that we're able to help people make massive, amazing change in a very short period of time is to give them an actual blueprint, a map of how they see themselves in terms of how they esteem themselves, the intrinsic value, the roles that they play, the extrinsic value, and the direction that they're headed, the systemic value. And once people see that map, which is for most of us, including myself, up until 1991, it was invisible because I couldn't see what I couldn't see. I didn't have a way to measure attention and clarity and how I thought. Now we can do that. And those three stress factors, self-sufficiency, which relates to the intrinsic, role frustration, which relates to the extrinsic, and goal frustration, are literally killing people. I mean, when you look at, and I know for years it did me, because that inverted value where no matter how good I did, no matter how well I did, I could always find fault with myself. I could always point to the 1% of things that didn't go right. You know, it's like we used to use an analogy and we use it in our training. If you got 9 A's and a C on a report card, which grade would get most of your attention? And for 70 to 80% of us, we don't even need to answer. We know. You know, this idea of perfection is a myth. This idea that we're going to have the perfect life, the perfect, you know, job, the perfect work, the perfect spouse, the perfect, it's all an illusion. That perfection dimension of systemic value is what's got us locked in. And if we pay too much attention to that, we don't have any airtime left over to pay attention to the higher levels of value, which is what we do and how we use up our precious time in life and how we feel about ourselves being intrinsic beings. I was with my dad the last 2 days. My dad is going to turn 88 next month. Up until about 6 months ago, he was a totally vibrant, I mean, amazing, amazing guy. And we lost my mom a couple years ago. And the difference between even 3 months ago when I saw him and today, he's like, he looks like a frail old man. And it just brought all of life, I mean, instantly into perspective for me that, my goodness, you know, all that matters to him is not anything but his family, his kids, his 20-something grandchildren, his 30-something great-grandchildren. That's what's keeping him alive. And how much we give up over the course of our lives, like Cartman said, you know, for what we think or what we want or what we have. And part of my purpose in bringing axiology to the world is to give people a model that they can use so that when they make a choice, whatever choice, they can make a choice and try to find that sense of balance where they don't give up the most valuable intrinsic experiences of life and extrinsic roles that they're going to play just for chasing another goal. And for a lot of people, it is so life-changing. I mean, literally, we've had people heal of illnesses, and I'm not saying I'm going to do my disclaimer here. You know, that's not the purpose. But so much of our inverted value system comes from the way we think. And if we have a map of the way we think and we see where our clarity is good and we see where our clarity is not, all of a sudden now that interdependence takes on a whole new realm of possibility, because rather than trying to think that you have to strengthen your weaknesses, which will ultimately weaken your strengths, you can actually play the game of strengthening your strengths and complementing those things that you don't do as well with and through other people. And that really, Mike, you know, is the whole essence of an interdependent world.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that's I'm glad to hear you saying this. You and I have had a couple of conversations before, but we've never really talked about our individual philosophies. And it's interesting for me to hear your philosophy coming out, because it validates everything that we're doing as well. Because we, you know, it's just like we talk about when people are working on gaps, they're giving up all the energy because the person can't work on a gap without using up significant amounts of energy because of the way the brain itself works. And we call it free energy when people begin to work on their strengths. In other words, when you work through your strengths, you spin off a lot of free energy. That free energy can be used for all types of things. It can be used for difficult circumstances, adaptability, performing functions that you want to perform and not are very good at. But you only get that if you work through strengths. If you focus on your limitations and work in gaps, that what you end up doing is really flipping over the values triad, in my view. You know, you all of a sudden lose all of the intrinsic leverage, and you end up with systematic problems because you're focusing in building areas that, in a lot of cases, should be delegated to other people. And that, you know, this is the same kind of work that Seligman did in forming the new resilience paradigm that they formed at Authentic Happiness, which is this idea that they found over the years studying what made people resilient. And the one new thing they've added in the past 10 years that no one saw before was the ability to reach out. And when we begin to reach out for help, for other types of resources, we actually begin to augment our system, because when we reach out through strength, we actually offer something to the universe and we get strength back, which helps us in areas where we're light in terms of resources and business reality. So this whole concept of working through strengths, interdependence, resilience, adaptability, is a very profound way to weave together all this system.
Yeah, and I knew when I heard your last conversation, that's why it prompted me to want to pick up the phone and call you. And one of the things that I've been working on a lot, I use the analogy, you know, Michelangelo, when he created David, the David, and they asked him, how did you do that? And he said, well, I really didn't do much. Essentially, the David was there all the time. All I did was chip away the excess marble to find the David inside. And I look at my work, my personal life's work, and my work with other people, is not to infuse them or imbue them with my wisdom and knowledge so much, unless, of course, they ask for it. My work is about helping you to chip away at all the excess marble that you've thrown on top of yourself over the course of your life to get down to who you really are. I call it essentially finding true north, nothing new, but essentially it's a process of chipping away. It's not a process of adding. And most of us are spending so much of our time, especially today, inundated with information, overwhelmed with information, adding, that we've put up so much marble. There's so much in the way of us seeing ourselves for who we truly are. And all the answers, really, for the most part, as to how to live your life, your unique way, are inside of you. And why I feel like the success movement is actually in some cases doing more harm than good is because this over-attention to modeling. You know, if you want to be good at something, just see somebody who else has done it and do it that way. Well, if your end game is just success, who could argue with that? But if the end game is to really be true to who you are and live your life from true north and find the David inside of you, modeling other people can be healthy if you learn from that, but the real game is to find yourself. And then once you find yourself and you value yourself for who you are, and that's a lifelong journey for me, I'm sure, because I still have that challenge every day, and then you decide, you know, how do I want to journey through this life, and what do I want to do, what contribution do I want to make, and then you set the goal within that construct, you're going to have a much more balanced life, you're going to have a much more fulfilled life, and you're going to live life much more from the inside out rather than from the outside in. And so that's really what my whole work is about, is helping people to release themselves and find that unique, one-of-a-kind David inside of each and every one of us. It's there. It's reachable. And if you can chip away at the marble, you believe it or not, you've got a great person inside of you. And so if there's anything I can do to help you chip away the marble, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, that's great. We're gonna go out to comments and questions in just a second. But before we do, I just want to remind everyone to, if you're not going to talk, make sure you hit your star 6 button, and you will be on mute. That way the call won't be so noisy. The other thing is I want to help you put another nail in the success coffin. Back in 2000, Chris Argyris, who is really an undersung hero of mine, wrote a book called Flawed Advice in the Management Trap. And in that book, he starts off the book talking about Stephen Covey and John Kotter and how the success people have said, you know, starting with Carnegie and Napoleon Hill and others, of modeling other people's success. And actually what he found was is that's not actionable. In other words, if I find you and you're successful and I try to mimic that and I don't have the same personality dimensions, I don't have the same energy, I don't have the same overall functioning, I won't be able to do that. And that's the big nail in the coffin of success people and motivational people that I've found over time, is that most of what someone else does to create success will not be actionable for you. And the thing that we have to do is to do what you're talking about and what I talk about in many different ways, and that is really find our soul, you know, find our soul's work, our soul's expression, and like you say, chip away the cultural marble that we have picked up over time in terms of what the expectations of others are. So let's go out and see if there's a couple of questions, and then we're going to direct everybody to a website where they can get some more information about what it is you're doing. Anybody have a quick question for Mitch? I think, can anybody hear me, or did everybody go on mute?
Yeah, I think I was on mute, but I was very anxious to find out how do we get a hold of these profiles? How do we go through the testing and being able
to... Sure. Mitch, you want to tell them where the website is they can
go? Yes, sure. What we did is we put together kind of a little intro package where you can get your foot in the water here. If you go to thenewgame.com/culture club, thenewgame.com/culture club, you'll see two links there. One is an intro package that we've put together where you can sample the profile. You can actually do the profile yourself and experience it yourself. And the that actually is pretty good value because we're giving you two profiles for the price of one, two different reports, as well as about 4 hours of additional audio downloads that you can listen to help you interpret it and understand what it's all about. And then the second link on that page gives you a little bit more information about a combination of a personal growth plus an income opportunity wrapped into one where you can actually become a reseller of these profiles. And I've used them in everything from corporate consulting to coaching. In fact, I feel very strongly one of the books I'm coming out with is The New Game of Coaching, How to Master the Art of Learning from Others. I believe The New Game of Coaching is about using this value profile because it's the only tool that measures clarity. And so how can you coach somebody if you don't know what their clarity is around these three dimensions? So one of the big emphasis points of the new game of coaching is not so much to teach people how to coach, it's to teach people how to be coached. The coaching industry will explode when we shift our focus from learning how to coach to teaching others how to be coached. Most people you meet do not know how to be coached. So you could be the greatest coach in the world, but if you don't know that a person has a lack of clarity in an area, or they don't know how to be coached, just like an athlete who hires a coach, but you hire a tennis coach and the tennis coach is trying to teach you how to be a track star, if you don't know how to be coached, no coach in the world is going to be able to help you get from where you are to where you want to be. So one of the next step in the process, if you choose to take it, would be to become a reseller, and that is the second link on that page, thenewgame.com/culture club.
Great. Thanks, Mitch. You know, I, as an assessment freak myself, I have not taken this particular assessment, so after the debrief today and the discussion, I'm really excited to get over there and take a look at that myself. I think that one of the things that I look for in assessments are things that they are able to uncover that other assessments do not, because all assessment models are just models of reality and every one of them is incomplete. And it's when we're able to begin to get more complete models, as you say, increase clarity about who we are that gives us the incredible energy that we're going to need to navigate the complex environment that we're all in.
Absolutely.
Is it available in other languages?
We have about a dozen. You can actually do the profile in Spanish. When you go into the login, it'll actually give you that choice. But we also have about a half a dozen reports in Spanish, and one of the, obviously, we're looking to bring this to all kinds of languages, but right now, all of them are in English, and about a half a dozen or so are in Spanish.
Good. Remind me when we talk next to talk with you a little bit about that, some opportunities there.
Sure.
We're trying to reach out to some of these other areas, and what we're finding is that often leadership in these other cultures are anxious to get tools with which they can use to create better cultures. And I think that this is probably one that may do that. Anyone else have a question?
Mike, this is Robert. Can you hear me?
Sure, Robert. Go ahead.
Mitch, once the values have been uncovered and you can appreciate, okay, these are my strengths, this is the kind of work that's appropriate for me, and an expression, I can't remember all of the categories that you used, then what happens?
Well, that's a good question. That's up to you. What we do is we've created the profile as a coaching tool. So our goal is to bring about change and in terms of giving people an opportunity to be coached. For most people that we work with, the next step is to be coached, is to say, essentially, how do you want to take this information and organize it in such a way where it becomes actionable? Some people, the action is to spend more time valuing themselves intrinsically because they just don't spend any time with themselves. For other people, it could be a very pragmatic outcome. For example, I'm changing careers, or I'm really frustrated with my role right now. I want to start a business, or I want to increase my business. How can I use this information to actually put my attention on the things that are going to improve my market value? Most of us have huge upside potential in our market value. One of the distinctions I make is if you look at a job description, the vast majority of people will shrink their value to fit a job description. And most companies, when they hire people, they will shrink the person to see if that person can fit the job. I was talking to the worldwide quality manager from GE on a plane flight recently, and we talked about this. And I said, imagine how your business would be transformed if you expanded the job description to fit the capacity of the human being doing the job. That instead of being confined to the narrow idea of what your job is, if you could actually redefine the job in the context of the person's capacity. So there's some very, very practical and high payoff activities that come out of this. We've had people, you know, everybody says, well, double, triple your income. Well, that's one goal, is to improve the quality of your market value. But there's also other practical applications, like are you spending most of your time, for example, doing $25 an hour work, not to demean $25 an hour work. It's very important work. But if you're worth $100 an hour, because your attention is focused on something that you think you have to improve, you know, strengthen your weakness, as opposed to putting your attention on what you really do well and then finding a forum for you to project that talent and ability into the market and get paid what you're really worth, we can help you to make that shift. Because many of us are spending time doing lesser value activities with a mistaken notion that we have to, or we ought to, or we should. That's all systemic thinking. So originally and as of now, it's created mostly as a coaching tool. In another 3 months or so, we're going to have some more self-coaching, and that's part of what we're giving you is some audio to support the self-coaching. But the next step is to actually implement what you learn from this to make the kinds of change that you want to make. For some of us, it's an intrinsic people with myself enjoying things. For other people, it's an extrinsic change. I want my roles to be reordered. For some people, it's a systemic change, meaning I want to actually lower my expectations because my expectations are killing me. You know, I expect to be someplace else, and I'm not happy that I'm where I am, and, you know, I'm giving up the present for the future. So it really comes down, Robert, to what you want to do with it, and that's usually what we discover and uncover in the coaching process. Is that helpful?
Yeah, very good. Thanks very much. I've seen it. You know, many times people can, you can unpack some of this stuff, and then it's, okay, this is unpacked, now what do I do?
Yep. I couldn't agree with you more. So for the people that want to do something with it, there's an immense array of possibility that we open up for them.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Hey, anybody else have a final question?
Mike, this is Rui. Well, I don't have a question. I just wanted to say that I'm overwhelmed by all this talk. I just couldn't really speak up really much, and I was just listening and really feeling much overwhelmed emotionally, really touched by all this talk. And I thank you very much for this this time with your. With your friend.
Yeah, thanks, Rui. I want to tell everybody that you're from Portugal and one of our younger students in Leadership University, and I appreciate you saying something about it. Rui is beginning to learn to articulate some of his feelings, and I think that what he's talking about in terms of emotional overwhelm is a good thing, Mitch. So appreciate your being here, Rui, from Portugal. I know it must be pretty late for you, so thanks for the effort there. We're going to go ahead and close the call now. I think what we'll do, Mitch, is probably see if we can get some people over to experience the assessment and then invite you to come back in the fall and talk a little bit more about some of the interpretations that some of us who have taken the assessment have gotten and how we can begin to implement that from a practical basis. So once people get a little bit familiar with the model itself and actually get into the nuts and bolts and mechanics of applying the information, we can get you back and have you talk to us a little bit about some of the strategies and tactics that you, over your 15-year experience with this, have found.
I'd be more than delighted to do that, Mike.
Yeah, that's great. Let's just give them the website again. It's thenewgame.com/cultureclub, all one word, all lowercase.
Yeah, that's it.
I thank you a lot for taking time out of your busy summer. I wish you best with your family's health and certainly with your son. You and I have shared some emails over a period of time as I ended up being a stay-at-home dad for my two girls, which was really a great training experience for me. And I know that you're enjoying something similar with your son. So we share that, and we'll continue to dialogue about that. The rest of you, thanks for coming. We appreciate you being here. Please tell your friends. We're going to send this out to you in terms of a recorded audio. So if you missed anything or want to listen to it again, you'll be able to do that. And we appreciate you coming to Executive Coaching Club as well as entertaining us. Mitch, we appreciate you very much. And, of course, your knowledge and everything is great. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye now.